Elvis and Supremes and Baby Love. That song made a hit today. So we're about to have a conversation that we recorded yesterday with Baltimore City Police Commissioner Anthony Batts. We went to his offices at police headquarters, had a long, wide-ranging conversation. We bring that to you today. Next month, he's promised to come on live to answer your questions and calls. But today's conversation is pre-recorded. We did at his offices at the Baltimore Police headquarters. So Commissioner, one of the things I've been dying to ask ever since it was in the paper had to do with the announcement you made the other week with the arrests around the Black Gorilla family. I remember when you first, very shortly after you assumed the commissioner's job, you raised the issue of the Black Gorilla family, saying this was at the heart of a lot of the crime in the city, a lot of the murders, the violence. And people, you were kind of roundly attacked around that. People kind of ridiculed that idea. That, well, you're from California. What do you know? This is not California. This is Baltimore. So in some senses, you may feel a little vindicated. Talk about, but I'd like to hear about your reaction to that, but also I'm really more interested in your analysis of why, what you think the extent of BGF really is in this community. But let me just start with what happened then and what you saw that you think other people didn't see.
I can't answer what others didn't see. One of the things that I do when I go into a police organization, a couple things. I survey the command staff and I ask them, you know, give me the resumes and the jobs that there are. And then I ask them, what are the top 10 issues within the organization? And so that's what you're going to see our strategic plan is based on, is those top 10 issues that came out. And we'll be talking about that this week on, with our strategic plan coming out. But the other thing I do, the third thing, which is what you're talking about, I ask them for a conflict map. And what that is what gangs are in conflict with each other within the city of Baltimore, which gangs have alliances with each other. And when I say gangs, and I had to clarify this within my conversation today, when I say gangs, I mean gangs, groups, crews. They could be neighborhood guys that come together for a conspiratorial act of crime. They can be a group of people who come together to do crime, or they can be anything for two or plus people coming together with the name called Bloods, Crips, what have you, to do crime. And so I had them identify and map for me where these gangs, groups, and crews are located within the city. We have, and the guys came up with terms like NFL, which are the streets, and I think the Southwestern District. Then you have another one like DJ Boys, and they're in the southeast portion of our city. And then it came up with the big name, which Black Gorilla Family, which reminded me when I was in California, that was a prison gang. So I asked, how active are they? And from the command staff themselves, my first week or so, they were saying that they're in our housing projects and they're taking over the housing projects. And whether we're talking about Poe Homes, Gilmore Homes, Latrobe Homes, all our major housing projects within the city were being impacted by the Black Gorilla Family. And as I listened to the command staff here, they were very much aware of that. But when I started talking about it outside of the police organization, and when I started looking at looking for statistics to see how many gang members we actually had within our city, our database was very low, which I started asking the question, why is the database so low? To which I was told that we don't track gang members formally within the city. We do have an outdated base that has some gang members in it. We have a system that's statewide, and in that statewide system, we had about 30 people all total, which told me a couple things that we didn't have a good grasp on from my standpoint. What were the motives? What were the causations? Usually when you have crime or violence within a city, it just doesn't happen. It's just not random. There's a story to it. There's a play that's going on, and you have to figure out that play. And if you're going to get in front of gangs, at least from the training that I've had with dealing with gangs in Southern California, and I come from an area that it was inundated by gangs as we tried to address those things, is that you got to know the motive, and you may not be able to stop the first issue because you cannot have an officer on every corner, but you should be able to stop 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 from happening. And that's what was occurring when I walked in the door.
So what's changed? For you, what's changed in terms of your strategies and tactics? When I saw you on television, or actually a replay on the web later, you were visibly angry. I could tell this wasn't like this put on. Let me show you how angry I am about this. You were almost shaking like angry when you were talking about this, what you saw.
Well, it's not as much as what I saw. I'm really kind of pissed at the loss of life. And as an African-American male, and I've said this too, we had a group of young African-American males that we brought together in December, I believe it was. We brought them together in June of this year in the summertime. And we sat them down. They were the 50 most problematic people, dysfunctional people in the Eastern that we have in the sister.
What do you mean by that? 50 most dysfunctional? What does that mean?
That's a kind way of saying we had a room full of killers who we brought in, people who just shot people, have been shot, and people who were just extremely violent. And we sat down, and what I told them, I looked them in the eye, and I said, I am just tired of the places I've gone seeing young African-American males killing each other. And it's dropping like flies. Like there is no humanity. There is no love for mankind. There is no thought process of taking life of a person who looks like you, or life, period. I mean, these guys are getting shot in the head. They're shooting each other in the head. I mean, they're trying to kill. They're trying to assassinate. And some of those neighborhoods, it's very problematic being a kid that grows up, because I always reflect my anger. Probably comes out as I reflect. I see myself as an 8-year-old kid growing up in neighborhoods like those, where I grew up. And the fact that, moms have to be concerned about their kids going to school or walking to the store, they shouldn't have to be concerned about that. They shouldn't have to live in fear. Not in these poor neighborhoods, not everybody there is a bad person. In these poor neighborhoods where people struggle, they shouldn't be inundated by these gangsters who have no reverence for life whatsoever. I mean, it's unacceptable for me. And the fact that we're battling our homicide rate this year is unacceptable for me. And I make no excuses for it. We will get better. We have to get better. We don't have a choice. And I think what you'll see over the coming months is that we are perfecting some skills that will make us better, to add on to the foundation we already have. But it's taken time to try to get the organization into, number one, understanding that we have gangs. I mean, they understand it. I want to be Pollyannish, but we haven't tracked gangs. So tracking gangs, understanding tattoos, understanding graffiti, understanding the motivations, knowing what conflicts are going on so we can get ahead of their decision loop. Because these things happen the same way. They'll go into a housing project. They'll do the same thing they did in the last housing project to take over that. And those are the things that will lead to violence, conflict with people who live in those housing projects. And so our job is to get in front of those things to prevent them.
So you don't agree with those who argue that the criminal underground in Baltimore City that fuels a lot of the murders and violence, people say it's the street corner. It's not organized gangs across the city, that these are neighborhood operations that may, you can argue about where they get what they sell or where they get the guns that they use, but that these are mainly neighborhood organizations. What you're saying is something is more insidious and deeper than that.
I think in my opinion, and speaking to my command staff and being out on the streets and talking to the residents and the citizens, you have both. You have drug locations that have taken place, open-air drug markets that take place and that have been there for some amount of time in certain parts, and all these things are localized within our city, unfortunately. But you have a direct focus of black guerrilla family taking over communities, and they're trying to spread much like a fungus in some of these very poor locations within the city. And when they spread, they don't allow you to be an independent vendor out there. If some of the conflict that we've seen is as they spread into neighborhoods and communities, they will tell the independent vendors, you will pay us 20% tax on anything that you're doing out there, and you will become part of us. It almost kind of reminds me of Star Trek when you see the Borg, and the Borg comes in, they say, we will assimilate you, and that's what BGF is trying to do in certain parts of these localized areas where we have poverty, is that they're just trying to assimilate these young people out there. And not too often do they allow you to operate outside their confines, and they will be very violent in bringing you inside the group, or they will take your life.
Talk about I don't mean individual names here, but who was arrested that day? How many were arrested? How many are still in jail that you arrested that day? And what comes of this?
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, we've had about three major cases where we've kind of kicked in doors. I have to recall which one you're talking about. But the last one early in the morning when we were out there at 4 a.m. in the morning knocking on doors and making entry into locations where we had search warrants, we had about I think it was about 30 people who were outstanding on that particular warrant. And don't quote me at the numbers because at my stage of life, they're starting to kind of mix together, and we'll get you the actual numbers. But I think we had about 30 people, and we ended up no, correction, that one was 20 people. And I believe we ended up having probably close to about 12 or 15 in custody. So we had a few out. And then 2 weeks prior to that, in the Greenmount area, I think we had a number closer to 48 that were outstanding out there. And the last count I had, we had about 10 who were still outstanding, 10 to 13 who were still outstanding. And that doesn't mean that we'll back off or give up on them. We will still pursue them. And they may get away today, but we are going to snatch them out of their shorts one day when they're not expecting.
So, and in the other end of the spectrum is, are all the cases that are not filed in the city, and we've talked about this before, and I was talking to some people today on this, on my program, which will be yesterday when we have this conversation, when it's aired, but about the alternatives to arrest. In other words, we had a conversation today about everything from people who are innocent young black people who are killed by homeowners, or the issues we've talked about before with young people of color being killed at the hands of security people in this country, both you know, both official and unofficial, or the on or the and then we kind of couple that in with this whole new spectrum of people who are doing their knockout games across America in different communities, and what all that means. And so we start talking about those kids. Let's say a kid does something like a knockout, or does something else that's equally as kind of disgusting. And the arguments being made was that there's alternatives to prison for those kids, and that groups like community conferencing or Dante Wilson and his rec center on the east side, where I've seen him take kids in groups of 12, and these sessions last for hours and hours after they do their homework, where they're talking about alternative ways of dealing with what they face on the street or in their school or wherever. So what does that play into it? I mean, I know you don't make the rules. You can't those rules. You don't make the laws, but you're the commissioner, so you do have a say. You have the bully pulpit. You have a way of putting things out there. So what's the alternative to always having hundreds and hundreds of young people arrested and in a confrontational situation with the men and women who serve under you?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I think not everyone who does a crime needs to go to jail. First of all, number one, the system can't hold that many people, and I think you're seeing the results of that in our court system today. If you look at public enemy number one, the young man that we had out there had an L in his forehead, middle of his forehead,
that
pronounced.
You brought up on my show when you were in the studio last time.
Right, pronounced nose out there. I believe his record, if I recall it correctly, he was arrested and actually sent to jail for attempted murder 3 times. He also had stabbed another person in the back and had knocked the teeth out of a woman, out of her mouth, just hit her face. And then the last one, he shot, I believe it was a 19 or 20-year-old young girl on the front of her porch, just shot her in the head. And I think when you see that, when someone like that, as vicious as they are, continues to be out on your streets, something's broken, something's wrong. It shows that we are, as a police department, doing our job, that we're making arrests. We've arrested them multiple times. But the system, for whatever reason, and not pointing fingers, is not able to keep him in. When you have a kid who may be doing something out of mischief out there in the summer when they don't have something to do, and they get into trouble, well, you should find a way to make sure that that child has hope, because a lot of times they're going to grow out of doing, you know, stuff like that. But I am very firm about this point. If you try to take a human life, if you take a human life, you need to go to prison. I mean, you need to go for a long time. You shouldn't be walking the streets so you can shoot people 3 times or 4 times or stab people. It's just outrageous. And part of what I like to push for is legislation that if you are a gang member and you're armed and you take a life, is that we need to discuss how we deal with that, you know, within our system as a whole. So I throw that out. I probably step on some toes by saying those things, but I, when you're taking human life, there is no go to the park and wreck. There is no when you shoot at someone with a gun. It is no when you do a robbery with a gun, it's King X, you get to go to the park. That's unacceptable. But if you're a young man and you're making simple mistakes, then you do need to be mentored and given chances. And that's also where the community gets involved. You know, the honest truth about this nationwide is that government is shrinking. Municipal, the federal government is shrinking. State government is shrinking. And also local municipality governments are shrinking. We're not going to have enough capacity to do programs like we've done before. You know, many times people talk about the Police Athletic League. I am a big supporter of that. I would love to do it, but we don't have enough resources to make that happen. And every city that I've been in, Parks and Rec has been impacted, and you're shrinking those to put the money in other places just for the government to run. And so that's where our community needs to step in. You know, there's a young lady who I visited, her center, she found money, went out and rented one of our closed-down Parks and Rec locations, and through raising money through private donations, started funding different recreation programs for the kids in her community. I was blown away by that. And I asked her, where'd you come up with this idea? And she says, well, I know government can't do everything, and I have an opportunity to do something for the kids in there. And she's able to get secondhand computers, so she allows the kids to do computer work in there. They have a place where they started a little small library in there. They have places where they have rap groups for the kids where they sit down and not through rap music but have conversations back and forth. And then she was bringing horses from different places where she met people to get these kids exposed to horses. And to a certain extent, and I'm not being Pollyannish about this, I think the community has to stand in some of these places where government, as we push back and we shrink the size of government, where government can't continue to push.
I mean, I'm thinking about what you just described. Is it, and not to get too deeply philosophical about this, because it's also practical. I mean, there seems to be a contradiction, though, there. On the one hand, you're saying that we can't keep arresting people for minor crimes. I'm going to explore that a bit more, and putting them in jail. But if the systems aren't there for us to send kids, in other words, then the alternative is going to be to arrest them. And if they pass this curfew law, and which we already have, I don't know why, I personally don't see why we need another one already exists, but if they were to make that harsher, and I mean harsher when I say that, then the men and women working for you will have little choice because there's no place to take the kids once they find them on the street. So,
well, we're saying the same things, but what we're saying is there's other ways to fund that. We're not saying that it's not a good program, that you should have different things. But there's a lot of foundations in the city of Baltimore. There's a lot of federal funds out there that can be tapped in to actually make these facilities and different things happen. Now, you said on the show, and I can see by your body language on that you had said that we don't have any of these things out there. This is doable. This is doable. We have a lot of programs out there. We just have to do a better job of connecting those programs and highlighting those programs. We don't have enough of those programs. But I just described to you this young lady who did this on her own, and she has a program, and there's other programs. There's programs like Midnight Basketball that's out there. Even the Police Athletic League, when you did that, that was police officers putting those things on. We just can't count on government to do that for us. You have retired football players, you have retired basketball players, you have retired people who live in our community. We have doctors, lawyers who are retired I heard a story at Patterson Park where they had kids hanging out years prior, and they felt the kids were a nuisance, and so the community came together to build a place for these kids to play football out there and cut the grass and put it together, and now the problems went away. The kids have something to do. And that wasn't government doing that. That was just people in the neighborhood said, let's get together. Let's be creative. Let's be entrepreneurs, and let's solve this issue. Now, in some of these communities where we're very impoverished, the people don't have the capacity to solve these problems. And, you know, when I was at in the northern part of the city in Roland Park, I was having a conversation with residents up there. And I said, you know, in a room, we have doctors, we have attorneys in here, we have people who have done very well, and we can focus just on our neighborhood. or we can start looking at Baltimore as a community. We can start looking at Baltimore as a whole. And if there's parts of Baltimore that are imploding upon itself and does not have the capacity, we need to step outside of our own community, our own neighborhood, and try to address these issues with young people who may not look like us, who may not speak like us, and they may not listen to the same music. But Baltimore is either going to fail and succeed as a whole, not as subsets of different communities.
This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to our conversation with Police Commissioner Anthony Batts. They were recorded yesterday at his offices. He'll be coming on live next month to take your questions. We'll take a real brief break and come right back to continue the conversation with Commissioner Batts. So I'm curious what you might have said to the Singapore group when you were there. I wasn't there that night. I couldn't be there. I had to have another engagement, so I couldn't be there. I was hoping to be there when you were there, but couldn't be there. But those are exactly the people you're talking about. That's the kind of engagement.
Yeah, that's an engagement, but it wasn't that group that I was talking about.
I understand that. Yeah. But that's the community you're talking about in terms of needs to be engaged in this community.
In all parts. And I think it's not just the Singapore group or northern part of the city. It's all the city. And you don't need funds. Sometimes you have a skill. I mean, you just think about it, where you have these Pop Warner or Little League football and baseball teams. Those are volunteers. Those are dads and moms who want to give time. There are radio announcers who want to give time. There's plenty of people out there who can volunteer their time. I mean, if you think about it, people spend hours looking at football on Sunday. Different people look at basketball during the week. If you gave up 1 hour, I mean, here's a very overly simplistic. If you gave up 1 hour a week just to mentor a kid, I mean, just think about it. 1 hour a week,
yeah.
Just to mentor a child, to give them exposure to see different things, to take them to a law firm or to take them to a doctor's office or to take them to a dentist and say, you can become this. What would be the impact within the city? If you took 1 hour and just helped a child to read, I mean, it may sound Pollyannish, but for me, that's a dramatic impact. And I'll tell you why, is that the journal articles that are out there are pretty clear. If a child cannot read by the time they're in the third grade, most likely they're going to drop out of school and not graduate from high school. If they're not graduating from high school and they're disconnected from school, they're going to be out on the street. If they're out on the street, they're going to do burglaries. They're going to be with people of an ilk that are driving them a different direction. So those are big issues for me as I deal with my crime rate. And also, how do you employ people when they come in contact with my police department and we have to arrest them for doing different things? How do you then employ that workforce within the city as a whole?
I want to circle back to what you were talking about in terms of arrest, but let me ask this question because it's something we touched on the program, and it's a very tough subject. But let me start this way. When we got together last, we talked a bit about the Tyrone West case. And the family and anything others really are trying to figure out, get an answer to this. Why is it taking so long for a coroner's report to come out? And I know, having interviewed medical examiners across the country, this can take time. But often when it takes this amount of time, there are political issues involved as well. I mean, it doesn't take 6 months to come up with a toxicology report or a report on why a person died and why they died. Why is it taking so long for this report to come out?
I can't answer that question because I'm not connected to, nor do I have insight into the coroner's office, nor do I have any knowledge whatsoever. But I can tell you, based on experience, it could be one or two things. It can be one that there's a backlog somewhere. When I've been at other places, it could be that it's a backlog. Or number two, it could be that the answer isn't that apparent. When we've had coroners in my history before, when you may have had a passing of an individual, it may not be as obvious as people think. If you don't have what is alleged, like bruising or trauma or different things along those lines, you have no idea. And so that's all I can kind of throw out there is I have no idea why it's taken so long. It would make it a lot easier on me if that information came out so we can move forward with the state's attorney's case to see if there's anything illegal that was done out there or not illegal done. And it will allow us to do our administrative case and move forward and to to give closure to the officers and to the family and to everybody who's involved and to the city, and to understand that that we need to foster the public trust. And the longer that it takes for the system, not just the coroner's office, for the system to get to a resolution or an answer to these questions, tears at the public trust. Because just like you were saying, is there a conspiracy here? Is there a bureaucracy in here? Is there politics going on in here? And I think it also, we just need to give answers to the community. I try to be as transparent as we possibly can for us. In the very near future, we're going to be coming forward with the Anthony Anderson case that's out there. It hasn't moved as fast as I'd wanted to. I want to move a lot faster, provide answers. But we're going to stand in front of a microphone and TV cameras, and we're going to answer all the questions out there. We're going to share what we found out and what happened out there, and we're going to give as much information as we possibly can. And I would like to do the same thing with the Tyrone West case. I think the family deserves that. I think the police officers deserve that, and I think the community deserves that.
But there's no sense of how long this is going to take.
Well, there's three stages. You have the coroner's report that nothing can move forward until that is right. That comes out. Then you have, at least for the police department, you have Mr. Bernstein, who's the state's attorney, who has to review, and they have to figure out if there's any violation of laws from that interaction or not. And then you have the police department that will do our administrative review. And what we're going to do is go outside the organization. We're going to bring experts in, and we're going to be highly transparent. And that's why when we go in front of the cameras, we have members of that panel that have no ties to the police department giving their opinions in what they saw and what occurred out there.
The other thing about that, and I think that, and I say this, I think it's important to kind of bring out, we've done this before together, but that, let me preface this way. Because every time you ask a question like this, people go, oh, you're making this broad brush and saying cops are all violent, cops are all bad, and that's the furthest thing from what I'm saying. I have a nephew who's a cop. I have friends who are police. I have students who are cops. So I'm not saying that by a long shot. But having said that, the question people have, I think a lot of people in this community have, especially in the poor working class sections of Baltimore, or where is the limit? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, and I'm not saying you don't have to be case specific here, but I will be for a moment. I mean, with the Anthony Anderson case, what is too much force? Is somebody being thrown to a ground and having cracked ribs? Is that too much force? How do you determine that? If you're arresting somebody and he's on the ground and people are witnessing him being kicked, is that too much force? I mean, at what point is force too much? And how do you begin to change a culture? When I was a kid, the police were pretty rough. They were really rough. People, they're not quite as rough as they were back in the 50s and 60s when I was in the corner, but there's a culture there that also has to be internally, that has to change internally. So those two things, I mean, how do you address that? Or do you think it's important to address that? Or are we making out here in the public too much of that from your perspective?
Part of what my job is to get a pulse on our community and see what's important to the community and how they perceive the police organization. I think when we come out with a strategic plan, you'll see that we ask the questions of the community, what do you think about your police department and how do you think we deliver service? Now, my job is to construct an organization that is able to respond to the wants of the community in the way that the community says that it wants the police organization, community being the city as a whole, to all sides. So that's number one. I think there's a legal standard for the use of force that you have to use that force that is reasonable for that situation from a reasonable person's standpoint. So one thing I can say is most people, when you're watching force, even when I'm watching force, other police departments that are involved in force, it never looks good. There's never a time when you're hitting a person with a baton that it looks good. There's just no context. There's no time when you're struggling, having to force someone to the ground that it looks good. There's none of those circumstances. However, I expect, and what I've put out to expectations, is that we have a very professional police department, and that's my expectations. And that is that you don't take things personally. You don't try to punish a person out there in the street. That's not our job, not our function. Our job is to use force. And there again, there's times we use it. It's not going to look good. And as long as we use force in a professional way, our job is to subdue the force or the resistance that's taking place, which at a level that is reasonable for those situations. And what that means is that you can't You can't take a bazooka to knock in a nail into the wall. You have to use that force that is reasonable. And it depends on the circumstances. If you have a police officer who happens to be a female who's about 5 feet tall and about, let's say, 110 pounds, trying to take into custody a guy who's 6'4" and maybe 240 pounds, the force that she's able to use is different than if the situations were reversed. So it depends on that particular situation. It depends on if the person has a weapon at all, if that person has a knife, if that person is stronger than officers. One of the things that we are moving forward with that I am a proponent of is that we're going to outfit the entire organization with tasers. Currently, we have about 300 tasers that are breaking down on us just because of the age. We've had them for a while. But we've just pushed through our budget process out of grant funds that we're going to be able to outfit our entire uniform patrol force with tasers. Now, there's different opinions about tasers that go back and forth, but many times when you use a taser, you're able to deploy the electrodes, and all they really do is they send an electrical current that tightens the muscles between those two electrodes. There are two prongs that come out between wherever those two prongs land, let's say between your chest and your navel, that entire area just contracts, and it sends a shockwave through your body, which basically makes you fall to the ground. The officer comes over, you handcuff the person, you check them out, and you make sure the paramedics come. And what usually you have to remove these prongs because they attach to your skin. Remove the prongs, check the heart, make sure they're doing okay, and then you take them to jail. You don't have any injuries to the victim, most likely. You don't have any injuries to the officers. You don't have anyone hit with a baton or hit with a stick. And it also helps an officer who may be small in stature going up against a person who's larger. And I think it will be a more humane way to solve crime overall. I also hold officers to a high standard in the fact that we have to have the proper training, and we're bringing training in so that officers have a reverence for life. And you heard me say that before, and I say that with conviction. I expect officers, when they come in contact with citizens, that they do everything that they possibly can from an officer safety standpoint, that they have a reverence for life. And what I mean by that is that you don't stand in front of a speeding car and point your gun and you have to shoot the person because you put yourself in that position, so you have to pull your gun and shoot someone. There's times that we have to use deadly force. I just ask that we're professional about it and that we have high standards, because I don't think there's anything more serious that you can do as a police officer than take a human life.
So if officers have tasers, are they going to be shot by their own tasers during training?
I think that's probably the most likely the way that we're going to do it. That's the way that I learned in the organizations that I came from, is that everyone gets tased and understand the capabilities of that weapon, and to make sure if we're going to use it on the public that officers also have to go through what that feels like. It's not pleasant, I can tell you that.
I watched a video of my nephew being tased during his training. That's why I asked the question. So the FOP came out with their own blueprint for improved policing. I know you've seen it. You've read it. I take it. So where's the difference between what they're suggesting and what you're suggesting? There seems to be a disconnect.
Not very much. No, there's not a disconnect at all. One of the things I did is when I was coming into the police organization, I was applying for the job, I read the document. And I think the FOP had a lot of very good ideas. I was extremely shocked by the fact of the perspective that they took on the things. When I walked in the door, remember I said I surveyed my command staff and said, give me the top 10 issues. I would probably say 90% of the issues that the command staff identify are the same issues that are within the blueprint for success that came out at FOP. And you'll see those same issues pop up in our strategic plan. So we've incorporated pieces of the FOP document into the overall strategic plan as a whole. So we're in alignment with things that need to be done.
What parts of that plan are you not in alignment with?
I can't tell you specifically. I haven't picked it up in a couple months, but there wasn't much in there that I disagree. There were some things that are seen from the perspective of the union with the FOP, because they're focused on wages, working conditions, and working hours. That's their focus. I have a focus from a management standpoint, and so some of the things that they had along those lines are tied to money. They're also tied to benefits and wages, and so I don't get into that. But overall, the running of the police organization, giving the organization the right equipment, better pay for officers, giving them reasons to stay, making sure the cars run, make sure that our stations are clean, make sure that we have locations, academies that officers are proud of. I agree with that 110%, and we're actually, I haven't been waiting on those things. I've been moving forward with those things since the day I've gotten here.
One of the things they said was, at least the officers saying, some officers are saying, is that, as they put in the report, they think the city is being duped because you spend all this money training police officers, and the vast majority of them on the force, the majority of officers on the force, are 6 to 10 year veterans as opposed to veterans with longer terms of service. And people are up and leaving and going to Montgomery County, going to Howard County, going to Baltimore County, going to Anne Arundel County.
That's been happening pretty clearly over the last 4 to 5 years. The organization has been dealing with that. And I probably would guess it probably started even before that. We are a training ground, unfortunately. And until we have competitive pay that goes on within the police department, I think you're going to see those things. Until we make sure that we have the best equipment. You got to remember, these young officers that are coming on, they're growing up in a computer age. And they're used to playing with computers and doing things with computers. We don't have computers in our cars. Hopefully within the next 12 months we'll have that solved where all of our officers are having tablets, kind of like iPads, where they pull up information, we give them data, they can pull up a wanted person's picture, they can have the background information, and they can get it within seconds. And so within their office, which is that police car, we shove all that data and information in there as quickly as possible. We're looking to do a lot of things that brings us up to the automation age of a progressive police organization. And I think when you see that we get there and we rebuild the pride within the Baltimore Police Department and we get that pay up, you won't see people leaving in the numbers that they are leaving. But it's going to take a turnaround of the Baltimore Police Department to get there.
A couple more things. One has to do with just the overall safety of the city. There's a sense the city is not safe. There's a sense from people that we police more intensely the areas that are full of tourists and center downtown and not in people's communities where they're needed. That's all. Well, let me stop at that level. I mean, just in terms of your strategy for dealing with that.
Well, I'm dealing with a political problem that goes along with that. And when I say, and I don't say political as being politicians, one of the things that Baltimore only focuses on from a media standpoint is the homicide rate. That's the only thing that we talk about. That's the only thing that we address. Well, there's a counterbalance to those things, which is when that's the only thing that you report on, then when people get upset, then you're responding. And the truth of the matter is most of our homicides or violence are localized in certain areas within the city. And so that means that when you don't talk about burglaries, when you don't talk about robberies, when you don't talk about rapes, when you don't talk about arsons, when you don't talk about thefts, I mean, these are all the things that really probably impact normal people on a day-to-day basis. I can tell you this, doing this job pretty close to 32-plus years of being a sworn police officer, I've gone to literally thousands of community meetings, you know, over my career. And in those meetings, I could tell you 99% of the times that I've gone to those meetings, people don't talk about violence. They talk about my car getting broken in. They talk about the blight that's in the area. They talk about me potentially being a victim of a robbery. So I would almost guess, number one, violence overlays our city, and that has to be brought down. That is the most important thing. The mayor has made it clear we have to bring that down, and we will bring that down. But the other issues are, in most other parts, is someone going to break into my garage and steal my lawnmower? That is a significant thing. Most people won't say compared to some of these other issues, but when you live in a nice neighborhood, having somebody break into your house and steal your lawnmower. I was just up in another part of the city last week where the people were very upset because they had 10 break-ins in their neighborhood and their community. And in where they live, that is an outrage. And what community policing is policing the city or policing a neighborhood in the special way that that neighborhood needs to be policed, because they're all different in their own way. So we should move beyond just focusing on homicides. That has to come down, period. Bottom line, no excuses to it. That has to come down. But number two, we have to make sure that we focus on these other pieces. Crime is usually tracked in 9 different categories. It's called Part 1 crime. And it's divided in crimes against person, crimes against property. And usually nationally, you look at all these different 9 categories, including arson. as in one of those subcategories is homicide too. So I think how we have to look at crime in the city of Baltimore is holistically. So we have to respond back to crime holistically. And we have to, and I think the mayor is putting together a plan now, which I'm very excited about, which incorporates the Baltimore Police Department strategic plan. The mayor has a longer plan to deal with violence that is a holistic approach to addressing.
A couple of very quick things. One has to do with when you're patrolling communities and getting communities to respond to the police. If we were on the air right now, we'd be getting 2, 3, 4, 5 phone calls. As you know, people saying how the police treat me in my neighborhood, being rude, being bullying, not getting out of their cars, not even know who I am, not know where I live. So, I mean, and when Bielfeld was in the seat before you, and we spent a lot of time, talking to Commissioner Bielfeld when he was here, I mean, it was all about getting police out of the cars and walking the beat and starting to get to know people. That really didn't happen. And it was sporadic where it did happen. I remember when I spoke to one of the graduating classes here, first thing I said to the graduating class here at the police academy was, you have to get out of your car. You have to go sit on the stoop, sit on the porch, have a Coca-Cola, have a lemonade, know people's names, get to know people, use their bathroom, have a cup of coffee. And that's the only way to really make people begin to trust you, given the minority of people in the force who are going to be rough and rude. So how are you addressing that? I mean, that to me is the crux in some ways of making this safer. If you don't have the trust of the folks out there to help you out, it's not going to happen.
I sincerely agree. And what we start with is saying exactly what you just said, is to be a good crime fighter, you have to have clues. And this is not like CSI on TV where you pick up a hair and you solve the crime within an hour. That's not realistic. Crime is solved by good old-fashioned police work where someone says, this is what a license plate looks like. This is a partial license plate. This is what the guy looked like. This is the house that he ran into. And as you said, which is very apropos, if the community does not trust you, if they don't think that you're there to help them, if they think that you're there to make the problem worse, they're not going to tell you stuff. And you're not going to tell you information. And you're absolutely right. We do need to sit on what I call a porch, what we call a stoop, and have conversations and tell people like I do on a regular basis, almost a weekly basis. I go out to communities that have trauma in them, and I sit down and I talk to people and I tell them what we're doing. I listen to them, more importantly. They tell me tons of information. You know, where we have this conversation that people, there's no snitching. That's not true. When you sit down and you talk to people, they'll tell you everything that's going on in their community. This person looks like this. This person looks like this. This is what's going on. This is what's happening. I get tons of information, and I bring it back, and I ask my command staff, do they know what's happening and what's going on in those different areas? But we are attacking this in a different way. Now when my recruits come out of the academy, their first assignment's walking beats. Their first assignments is in some of our toughest areas. They're assigned to walk and have a geographic area that they have to walk on a daily basis. And what I'm trying to do with that is get them used to and breaking, number one, breaking all the fears in the community. Number two, to get them to know that there's a lot of good people in these communities out here and know who they are and talk to them and try to build intelligence. And that's one of the things that we have to do a better job at, is that we do not gather intelligence as well as we should. We're moving in that direction. We're doing a better job. We need to do more cultural awareness within our communities. My job is to give my young officers more tools in their toolbox so they can deal in communities. And to be perfectly honest, we have some police officers that come from because we bring police officers in from the world. Some officers haven't been in some of these tough neighborhoods, and it's kind of shocking to a certain extent. And so we have to give them tools in a toolbox on the norms, the values, what happens in these communities, and how you can be at ease. So we're not only doing training, giving them tools in the academy, we're also having them do walking beats, exactly what you're talking about. So every academy class that's come out since I've been here has been on a walking assignment. They have done walking beats for at least their first 3 to 4 months that they've been out there before they go into a police car. The other things that we're trying to do is that we've started a reporting unit. We're calling it TRU as an acronym. And what we're doing is that when officers are injured or hurt, we put them in a room and we start taking reports over the phone. And the purpose of that is to free up time for police officers to get out of their cars to walk. Because right now, our officers are going to a lot of calls. They're taking a lot of reports. We're very service-oriented in our calls for service here in the city of Baltimore, probably more so than any other city that I've seen that I'm aware of. And what I say, these are calls like my cat's in a tree type of calls. And literally what officers have told me is that we've had hospitals call us and tell us to go out to someone's house and say your daughter hasn't been here for their appointment in 6 months. I mean, you don't do that at other police departments. That's a very service-related thing. So we're finding other ways to make that happen. And so standing up this TRU unit will give us more time to get officers out of their cars, to allow them to walk, to allow them to sit on the stoop. Right now, we don't have the time to sit on stoops to make those things happen. But I think we're moving in that direction. I'm very happy about it. I'm very happy about the things that we have created within the last year or so and building on the foundation that was already there.
Commissioner Bass, thanks for letting us in your house to have a conversation.
Yeah, come on, anytime.
That was our interview with Commissioner Anthony Batts. And if you have any questions for the commissioner that are still unanswered, please email us at steinershow@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And the commissioner will be on here live in December, and we'll bring other shows to comment on this coming in the coming week. So we are now about to take a brief break and come back. It's time for Sound Bites, our weekly look at the environment, our food and farming system. We'll talk about many things, including what's happening over in Reservoir Hill and White Lock Farms, and hear a great interview from a great recipe for Thanksgiving coming up, and a conversation about phosphorus, chicken manure in our water, what you're doing to us. Stay with us.